my thing
Love
over here.
Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is a special edition of MJ Network, Speak Out with Fran Lewis. Joining me today is former FBI agent Michael Tadman, and we're going to talk about the tragedy that happened in Manchester, the attacks last week, and what might have been behind them, how the terrorists set off the bomb, and other questions that everybody is still asking, and the reaction around the world. So, good morning, Mike. How are you doing? And thank you for doing this.
Good morning, Fran. Nice to be with you. Nice to be with you again.
Yeah, this is important. So is it true? Can you tell us what we know? I think everybody needs to know the facts of what's fact and what's fiction. What do we really know that happened that day?
Well, what we know, we had, you know, a individual bomber in of himself as a suicide bomber that had planted himself in a publicly accessible area between, you know, the venue, the concert venue, and a transportation hub. So clearly, you know, someone had planned this out. Again, found that soft target that, you know, we've always talked about. You and I have discussed it many times when we have these bombings. And, you know, did maximum damage to really mostly kids and innocent people, as most of these terrorist events are. Just hurting innocent people, killing innocent people, and accomplishing nothing.
I know. That's scary. And they killed all those people. But why? What happened with security? They said, and I read like 30 articles before I did this, that security was lax. How come? And but like you said, it's a soft target outside the perimeter. You know, there's very little they can do. But how come
right.
it has
Right, exactly. And there's a couple
of
thoughts. And I was on another radio show recently. It was on NPR discussing this, and we were discussing, you know, whether or not that tends to be more lax security on the part of whoever is providing security on the way out. You know, the sort of the sigh of relief. Mm-hmm. We went through the concert. Everything's okay. We made it through. That would, you know, through the most vulnerable time. And maybe, you know, at that point, security becomes more crowd control rather than security. And that's probably true. I myself was at a big concert here in Kansas City. And, you know, it's on the way out. It's just a matter of getting people out quickly. You know, obviously not checking bags anymore, clearly. But, you know, there doesn't seem to be an alert for people approaching the venue. Because you have, you know, parents meeting their kids, cab drivers meeting people. It would be almost impossible to control that sort of ingress towards the venue at that point. Not into it. Obviously, everyone's leaving. So, you know, there might be a way that we need to look at, are we leaving a weak spot at the end of the event? Are we letting our guard down? I'm not saying they necessarily did that, but it is certainly a conversation worth having within the security industry. Look at that. But then, as you just said, we're looking at soft targets. And unfortunately, there's always going to be that area that is not secure. We have a tight perimeter around the venue. And so let's say we put up guards and metal detectors 10 feet away from the points of entry for a venue. There's always going to be that choke point where the non-secure area meets the secure area and people are waiting to get in. You can keep extending the secure perimeter endlessly, but there's always going to be that point at which is non-secure and people vulnerable. And, you know, there might be other answers for that. You know, again, I think, you know, again, cameras, maybe plainclothes, police officers, but you can't stop something that you can't see. And if you have someone who just cannot be detected as wearing a suicide bomb, you can't detect them. Maybe if you have dogs out there, you know, you see them on the way in, you know, detect them as they're approaching. But again, there's only so far I could go. Now, of course, as you get further away from the secure area, you'll have less and less people, you know, accumulating around an area. There'll be a less likely target. So the more you spread that out. So maybe, you know, again, as we approach the area, we have, you know, bomb-detecting dogs. Maybe look for a behavior analysis, which we have not been very good at in terms of, you know, trying to detect suspicious people. But maybe a little more of that and, you know, bring it to a realistic point where we think the threat is minimized now because we just don't have that many people around. Not that they couldn't hurt somebody, but remember what terrorists go for. They go for theater. So the more casualties, you know, the more theater it is for them. They want mass casualties. That creates more news.
You're right. And unfortunately, this guy was sucked into this, and he died. He thinks he's going somewhere. He's going to get to burn to crisps. He doesn't. Nothing's going to happen. He's not going to Allah. He's just gone. That's what's scary. And, you know, people wear suspicious clothing. People see people, and then they go into a concert, and I guess, and they're not even thinking about someone's going to blow this up. So that's even more scary. So what about the
right? And we can't be on code yellow, you know, all the time. It's just not within our a mindset. It's not how we live in this country, and I wouldn't want to see that change. You know, I went to the concert, and now I'm always a little aware of my surroundings just because of my background, but I don't live in a constant state of awareness. I'm not always watching what I'm doing and where I'm going and looking for counter surveillance. Now I'm out with my wife, my family, my friends, trying to have a good time.
Yeah, I agree with you. But, you know, growing up in the South Bronx, I always used to watch who's walking behind me, on the side of me, in front of me. And I'm in a secure area, and I still do it. That if I hear footsteps behind me, I let the person go. It's just a thing. You know, you're just sort of like aware. And I've always said in all of my shows, if you see something, say something, just even if
absolutely.
You're wrong. You know, that's
the absolutely.
Point.
It seems so simple and somewhat trite, but it really is actually one of the more effective messages out there. So if you're sitting, you know, if you go into a concert hall or any similar venue, you know, the things we look for, suspicious people, obviously, you know, someone trying to keep their clothes closed, you know, like a jacket or something like that, in an inappropriate way. The old thing, the package, that, you know, maybe it's innocent, but if it looks like no one is taking ownership of it, you know, who's going to leave behind, you know, a package, especially a knapsack or something like that, you report that to security. Or someone who's just, you know, looks to be where they shouldn't be, looking in vents and boiler rooms, you know, really checking out restrooms more than just using the restroom. That's the kind of suspicious activity that we should stay alert to and report it to security or police right away. And if you're wrong, you're wrong. But let them make the decision as to what to do.
I agree. So what about the leaked pictures that shows Manchester attacked a suicide bomber, and who leaked them? Did the reporters in the United States really leak those?
Well, it appears, because it appeared in the pictures of the bombing, that appeared in New York publications, United States publications, it would appear it came from, you know, United States sources. And I don't know what the motivation was behind leaking those. You don't want to tell everything that you know. I mean, obviously the public has a right to know, and in due time they will know when the case is resolved, you know, with arrests and prosecution, at a time that the authorities feel they've neutralized that immediate threat. But, you know, you don't want to give out the evidence. You don't want to give people ideas of how to create bombs and let them know what they're looking at. Yeah, I mean, even though the bomb makers know that, that the bomb holder, you know, the actual suicide bomber, you know, his remains have been identified. Obviously, we're going to get forensic evidence. You know, I always like to point out that as destructive as bombs are, they leave a tremendous amount of forensic evidence. And even some of the most destructive bombs, we had Oklahoma City, the World Trade Center bombing in 93, not 9/11. Those things were solved pretty quickly. You know, the perpetrators were identified quickly because of the forensic evidence left behind. There's a lot to trace after an explosion, the Boston bombing as well. A lot of evidence is left behind. But here, you know, we know we have a network now, and any little bit of evidence that reveals what the authorities know just certainly cannot help in terms of the further investigation, tracking people down. Because they, the perpetrators, I didn't think of that. Now they know this. I have to destroy this piece of evidence. I have to, you know, now maybe stop. Well, we want them to stop anything they're doing, but, you know, maybe they're going to move from one safe house to another, that we might be on their trail. So there's really nothing to be gained at that point from releasing that kind of forensic evidence. Nothing should be leaked. Let the authorities make a decision as to what information they want to give out. Again, yes, the public's right to know is there, but more immediate concern is the security of everybody, and then, you know, taking this investigation to its logical conclusion, which is identifying as many people as they can, getting them into custody, and preventing another attack.
That's true. Sometimes I think the media is just interested in hyping and story, and they're not really thinking about how it's going to affect the public or anything else. I mean, this is horrible. So,
and sometimes they show restraint. You know, times when authorities may come to them, ask them to hold it. Again, you know, they have, you know, the morality and ethics has to be their guide. Sometimes, you know, the media in their frenzy could be the first one out with the information. Sometimes may not even be aware of the damage they could be doing by releasing that. Again, they're not law enforcement, security personnel, they're reporters. Their information is to, you know, get out the information. But perhaps, you know, in these kind of situations, they should be more aware and collectively, you know, go to the authorities and say, hey, here's the information we have. Is any damage going to be done? And then respect the wishes of law enforcement if they're reasonable, which is reasonable to say, hey, yes, if you let that out, you're exposing some of our case, and you're giving information to would-be bombers. Please don't let that out. And if they make, you know, I feel a legitimate argument, then the media should hold back on releasing that. Nothing's gained by releasing those photos.
They can't.
And it hurt our relationship, of course, with very close allies.
Yeah, I know, and it has already. They can't even stop them, even though there's freedom of press. They should have freedom of intelligence and realize that they're doing something wrong. So Theresa May raised the intelligence level, and people have made comments, and this has bothered me, is that you can't trust anybody, especially the United States. How has this changed our relationship with England or anybody else as a result of this? And I won't even get into what I think of what he's doing.
Right. Yeah, I had a feeling you were going to go there with that question. It certainly doesn't help. You have information, when we share information with other intelligence agencies, even within our own intelligence agency. So, for example, when I was with the FBI, if we received confidential information from DEA, it was not ours to share. I couldn't just make a decision, well, it's in our possession, I'm going to go to Customs now or the NYPD and give this information. It wasn't ours. You have to respect ownership of
mm-hmm.
intelligence, and that's what that is. It's ownership of information. They own it. It wasn't for us to share. It's certainly never ours to leak, whether it's our information or someone else's. The worst threat there are the people who do leak that information. I don't know what their motivation was on this particular thing, why they'd let out those pictures of the bomb in very specific details. So that is a threat of leakers. But again, when it's not your information, you don't share it. You hold it really carefully because you will lose the trust of your partners. And when that happens, I won't say it's irreparable. We've been very close with British intelligence and law enforcement. I worked a case in the Bureau where, Scotland Yard came out to New York and working on a case. We worked together. We coordinated an arrest with the Swiss authorities when our subject fled. So we'll work closely with them. It's not irreparable. We have these close bonds, but it does hurt for the time being. You don't want them questioning, can we trust the American authorities?
I agree. Now, the guy that did this is dead, so you can't question him. And he's supposed to be dead. He thinks he's up there somewhere. He's just nowhere. So how many people were arrested in connection with this, and they detained his father and arrested the brother? And this is just scary. And this morning I read they got more people. So just how many people were involved? And according to somebody high up in the British government or law enforcement, that there's a network that's unfolding that did this.
Just right. Last I heard, I think last week, I think 8 people had been arrested. And now, if there are more this morning. So we are looking at a substantial number of people who are involved. That's clearly a network. Those are people working in collusion. And it does make it more of a threat when you have people operating to help each other.
Mm-hmm.
You have bomb makers and planners and counter-surveillance and intelligence and, people coordinating back if they are ISIS-related, as they appear to be. People, acting as a liaison between sort of ISIS Central, as we say, and those operating in Europe or even our homeland. Hopefully not. So you have that kind of network. They're very dangerous. A lot of power behind numbers. Numbers is the strength in numbers. They work with each other. They can hide each other. But again, when there's a network, it also opens up more opportunities to be exposed to law enforcement or intelligence because they must communicate. Someone gets sloppy with what they're doing. There's more chances of error because there's more moving parts. So, on the positive side, if you can even say that, which I don't like to use that term, when you have a number mm-hmm. of people involved, there's a greater chance, of exposure. Because you often hear us talk about the threat of the lone wolf. Someone who sort of operates in the shadows by himself. I always think of the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski,
mm-hmm.
just out there on his own. Nobody's thinking about him. He doesn't do anything that attracts attention. He doesn't communicate with someone where the communication may be intercepted either by accident or design or someone else doesn't betray him, again, either deliberately or just by having loose lips. So each type of element, the lone wolf and the organization, pose unique threats.
Why? The question that everybody's been asking, and I know that ISIS doesn't think that Ariana Grande is what they would call a great role model. Why did they target her concert? Why her? Because there was a whole lot of info about why they think that she's not what they would want as a young person. She's 23 years old. She's who she is, and everybody aspires to her. There's a lot of people, little kids too. So why did they go after her? Why her in particular?
I'm not convinced it was her in particular. These people may have this affiliation with ISIS, this may not have been sort of like we say ISIS Central, where the you know, the ISIS hierarchy said, let's go after the Ariana Grande concert.
Yeah.
These might be individuals who are associated with ISIS, ISIS-inspired, who may decide to do this on their own. And again, they go for numbers, they go for shock value, they go for something that's going to, you know, get them news, as it did. So I don't know if it's so much the performer as it was the venue of a lot of young, innocent people. You know, again, large numbers, something that's going to attract attention. You know, again, it was a star, not necessarily that it was her, but a star that would, you know, get a lot of media attention. I think it was more the target of opportunity than it was necessarily the performer. I don't think it was her in particular that attracted the bombing.
Mm. Yeah, well, she's brave enough to go back again, and I hope that nothing happens. So if they knew that he and his brother were members of ISIS or something like that, and were taken into custody before the killer and his brother, why didn't they monitor them closely? And several people that worked with them reported it, and why didn't they do anything about it? That's what's really scary.
You know, this is the question that comes up often. You know, it came up, you know, with the Boston Marathon bombing, you know, after the oldest Sania brother is supposedly on the radar for his travel back to, I believe, the Caucasus and, you know, his homeland. And the inherent problem is that in, you know, democratic societies, and, you know, theirs is similar to ours, not exactly the same, but similar. One, there's a certain amount of freedom people have to move around. And there's a criteria for following people or being very intrusive in monitoring them, wiretapping them, you know, as we have here, very strict rules, which doesn't mean we don't do it. Obviously, we do. But when you have a multitude of people that you're following, it's never been a problem. The problem in intelligence has never been a shortage of information. It's always been the abundance of information. And sorting through that to determine, you know, which is that one needle that we want to find. We find the needles, but that's which is the right needle. So many of these individuals have come to law enforcement or the intelligence community attention because of travel they've done, or they have communicated with somebody under investigation or being targeted. They've posted information on websites or other social media that are being monitored by law enforcement and intelligence. So they come under our suspicion, you know, on the radar. We may open a case on them, which is maybe just putting some information, checking their records. But the ability to monitor someone's activity day in and day out is just not realistic. Now, if you have one individual and you have specific information that he is involved in an imminent plot, you know it's going to go soon, and you want to dedicate people to following him around 24/7 for X number of days, we can do that on limited scope. But it has to be specific. But if we're just talking about all the people in the universe that we're looking at in terms of their travel, suspicious behavior, you simply cannot monitor what they do on a day-to-day basis. And we see, you know, with these big borders on any country, with all the, you know, security there, that we're closing borders or whatever reason, it's hard to get in because it's ISIS-controlled. It's very hard to stop an individual, one particular individual, from making his way across borders. So, again, it's easy to say, well, he's on the radar, why aren't we watching him? Because you have to pick and choose. And I tell you, we've even had cases, I think, back in FBI history where people have slipped surveillance when they were under, you know, that kind of very heavy surveillance. Because it's also very hard to do without being noticed. You know, someone who's kind of savvy, you know, will notice cars and even planes now and other type of elements that we use, and it's not impossible to slip surveillance, you know, if you're trying, you know, other than actually stopping the person, taking them into custody. So it's a risky business, and we just can't follow the next terrorist bomber with absolute certainty over and over again. It's just not a realistic thing to expect. It's a goal, and law enforcement tries it, and they try to pick out the most likely target, but again, we have to deal with the realities of what we can do.
I mean, it's almost like at the airport when they when you just walk in, you don't know before they go to security or anything, when they stop you, something could happen. You don't even know. You have no idea who just walks into the airport pretending to go on a flight and they're really not. And now they're having this thing where they don't want cell phones and laptops and any electronics going to foreign countries. And who knows if that'll stop anything. That's scary. So
well,
what friction has
we have to respond to the threat. So, you know, when TSA comes out with these rules, I mean, not everything TSA has done, you know, I think we've all been a fan of. I certainly think TSA is fairly ineffective and inefficient in many ways. But when they come out with these specific, you know, rules on bringing things in, I have to believe and I trust that they're basing this on intelligence that's coming to them from the law enforcement and intelligence communities. I mean, they themselves are neither law enforcement nor intelligence agency, and that's not a slight on them. It's just they do what they do. But they get their information, and they have to act. So if they get information that's fairly credible, that the use of cell phones or computers is now a real threat, they know a terrorist group or any other organization has been looking to use them as a bomb, they have to take more precautions than they would if they didn't have that information. You know, once they know it, it'd be irresponsible not to do something. You know, it's got to be a realistic approach, but they have to do something then to minimize that threat. So I think if they do that and not being overly intrusive unnecessarily on your privacy, on your body, we should cooperate and just do the best we can. We certainly, you know, rather go for safety than, you know, worry about a small inconvenience.
Yeah, I understand that. I agree. So what friction has this caused between the United States, British security, and other intelligence officials? I mean, this is like creating a whole bunch of problems for us.
It is. And as I said earlier, I think it'll, you know, certainly everyone's all right, clamp down here. We can't share this with the United States authorities. They have a leak somewhere, and that we're assuming it's coming from us because it was in United States publications. We don't know that for sure. That's the issue with the leak. You don't know where it's coming from. But as I said, I don't think it's irreparable. We have to work together. We have to trust each other. And, you know, hopefully we're working hard to identify the leaks. Again, most investigations for leaks are unsuccessful, but maybe we'll get lucky. But I don't think it's irreparable. It will continue on. We cannot cut each other out. This is a universal global attack on terrorism.
I know. And the problem is that we all need to work together, everybody. And that's just scary. So was this guy on the no-fly list? And a Muslim community claimed that members of the public called the hotline and warned that something, that he was going to do something, and they didn't do anything. And then two people from his college called separate times. They were worried he was supporting terrorism, but they didn't succeed in stopping him. So how come the calls weren't taken seriously? Or did they just, you know, think that maybe they were just calling? Or did they do something about it and not think anything of it?
That's talking about the British authorities with the Manchester bomber? Is that what you're talking about? Yeah. Well, again, you know, it's hard to speak for what they got. And, you know, and these comments you always have, I called and I told them this. You have to take some of those with a grain of salt. That's not necessarily what happened. The call, even if there was a call, it might have been a lot more ambiguous than what they're reporting it as. And we don't know that they didn't do something and maybe didn't find something. Again, even here, you know, with some of our domestic, you know, terrorism that we've had here, we've heard, the FBI was out there. They spoke to the person. They interviewed him. I believe they did that with Sarnaev, and I believe they may have done that with the San Bernardino shooter, though I'm not sure on that one, where we've interviewed them and then didn't open a case. And we said, how'd you let that happen? Well, unless, you know, something specific comes up, there's not much more the authorities, especially here in the United States, can do. They interview someone. They look at their records. They check their activities. They do a little poking around. If there's nothing sticking around, someone's, you know, anonymous call can't be the basis for opening a full-fledged investigation on somebody.
No, I agree. You can't. You know, you just don't know. But how can people that go to a concert or anywhere, how can we weed them out since we know that they're there, they're here? Are there any warning signs, or where do they usually hold up and to plan an attack? I mean, people go to concerts, they go to basketball games, they go to Madison Square Garden, they go to all these big venues. So what should they look for? I mean, this before we get into poor Ariana and what she's going through, how do you know what to look for? Or how would anybody know, would security know what to look for?
Well, again, and this is where this has been the challenge in the day of terrorism, you know, this monitor of terrorism. And, you know, people have questioned, is security even real? Is it just a myth in the era of terrorism? When, as you and I are discussing now, there's so many ways where it'll be introduced, you know, a deadly device somewhere. So it comes through a lot of different moving parts of the intelligence community. So one involves, you know, intelligence itself, information. We have to have sources of information out there. In the community, reporting suspicious behavior, a way of filtering that information through, you know, certain task forces and interagency working groups that we have. You know, in the FBI, I can tell you, I was working a case with the CIA. Before 9/11, we did work with them. You know, these interagency cooperations do exist. They're only more so now since 9/11. So we have to get the information in there. We have to be active, proactive, as we do monitor social media, monitor any information that we could do legally. You know, looking for those threats and I do stress legally, but I think we always have enough power to do what we have to do. Never in my career in the FBI did I ever feel I needed more power. It's how we use it. We have to be creative. Mm-hmm. So, and if something is hurting us in terms of legislation, law, require new legislation. You know, get new legislation. Go to the congressman and say, hey, this is what we need. We need more power in this respect, whether it's monitoring, wiretapping, or even manpower. So we have to have the information out there. The community has to cooperate. Many times they are the first source of information. They know what their friends and their neighbors and you know, are doing, and they can report suspicious behavior. We have to filter it, share it, and we have to put in some actionable use. So again, if we get information, we can't ignore it. Go out there, interview people. Maybe do a limited surveillance on somebody. Check some records, some phone records. Run names through databases and see if we have a potential threat out there. At the venues, then we have to have, information shared with the venues as well. You know, such as if we suspect somebody, we can't wait for them to get there first. You know, find the FBI's three cars behind. We have to let security know, and we have to stop them before they get too close. So we have to be proactive. So we have to share the information. We have to have maybe more detection. As you and I discussed, maybe, you know, bomb sniffing dogs outside. I believe in plainclothes security. I always have, even from times when I was a cop, and I did plainclothes then. When people don't think that, you know, they don't see the threat, if you have a bunch of uniforms somewhere and, you know, they may feel they're comfortable, that's when they get sloppy. And that's what you get seen. That's why, you know, in plainclothes, we were able to pick up, you know, more shoplifters and people committing crimes and guys in uniform for the obvious reason. That they don't do it when they think they're being watched. So I believe in, you know, plainclothes, detection, more cameras on the outside, you know, again, looking for that suspicious behavior, you know, maybe go, you know, several yards or many yards beyond that choke point, you know, where the soft target meets the hard target, and look for that suspicious behavior, the car circling the area who just doesn't look like it belongs, someone taking something out of the trunk, someone donning something and then putting a coat over it, you know, that looks suspicious. More of that, more surveillance. And again, we've talked about recognizing suspicious behavior. I believe in that. The problem is we've never mastered that in this country. TSA has tried it and not quite successful at doing it. The Israelis are very good at that. Right now I'm working with someone on trying to bring some Israeli training here locally, law enforcement, you know, giving their expertise and, you know, learn from people who do things better. And they certainly, you know, do that aspect better, you know, that suspicious behavior recognition, and then how to approach somebody, what to do about it, and how to do it in a legal and respectful way in case we're wrong. So a combination of many factors that we have to come together to make give us an effective deterrent, or at least a way to stop the terrorist attack before it happens.
Hopefully someday we will. I mean, after what happened this morning again. So as Ariana finished her last song and the people realized that the bomb went off, people at time panic, correct? And they get scared, and then other people get hurt. And what should people do? I mean, when something like that happens, what are you supposed to do? How are they supposed to react? I mean, that's scary.
You know, and here's the problem, especially with that. Again, at least people heard an explosion, and they assumed, even though it was correct, they assumed it was a bomb as a threat, which is what we want you to do, right? If in doubt, assume it's a threat. Worst thing can happen, you get out. And we always want to leave the arena, but sometimes, you know, we don't know where the next shoe may drop.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can't blame people for panicking and jumping over rails and trying to get past people. Everyone wants to survive.
Mm-hmm.
So the instinct is, we're under terrorist attack. I want to get out of this facility. Of course, unfortunately here, you know, the way out was where the bomb was. But you have to maintain your cool. See if you can detect where the threat came from. You know, again, it's impossible to know if there's another shoe that's going to drop at a certain area, you know, on another exit, but you have to use your best judgment. Generally, it's best to get out of the facility. But watch where you're going. Watch what you're doing. Try to be orderly. Don't panic. Try to help people on the way if someone's been disabled. You know, try to get them out if you can. If someone's being crushed, a child, or someone elderly, help them out if you can, you know, and all survive. We got to help each other. It's a group effort.
I agree with you. You know, people that go to the movies, I haven't been to one in a while, but I do know a lot of times in the prologues or whatever, they usually tell you where the exits are in the movie theater, that if this is blocked, you can go this way or that way. They don't do that when you have a concert and make people aware of the different ways to get out of the theater in case, God forbid, there's a fire or something happens and they have to evacuate.
You know, that's a good point, Fran. I'm trying to think now. The recent concert I was at here, if they did that, and I don't remember that, probably not a bad idea. You know, maybe they should do that. And
I'm just wondering.
No, I'm saying, do that. Maybe, highlight where the exits are. Remind everybody that to be calm and, what's the best thing to do in the event of an emergency. I think the problem is, they're afraid of scaring everybody, but we do live in scary times. I think that's a good idea. Don't think it hurt. I know, my wife and I do go to a lot of movies, and we see those things. We also see the message report suspicious people. I think that's terrific. It's a way of reinforcing the concept of see something, say something. And we do. We take note of where the exits are. And I always mention to my wife, in case someone walks in here and, starts shooting, as we know happened, here's what I want you to do. And I remind her of that, to take cover, lay low, kind of follow me, I'm going to get you out of here. So, it's not a bad idea. It's unfortunate, and I wish we didn't live in that environment, but we do, and we want to survive. So I think you're making a very good suggestion.
I mean, everybody goes to the city. And the last time I was there, I was like in awe. I hadn't been there in a long time, and I must have seen hundreds of people on the streets on their cell phones. You don't know who they're talking to. You don't know who they are, but they're all of different nationalities, different worlds and everything. And there's very little you could do if somebody stops in the middle of the street. But you walk in even to a hotel, you walk into a hospital or anything, and anybody could walk in. That's what's really frightening. They don't stop you to ask you, are you checked into the hotel? They don't ask you anything. They don't ask you if you're visiting. Well, now some hospitals won't let you go up unless you have the name of a patient and where you're going. But then there are people that sneak in. And you often wonder, I had surgery last year, and I'm going like, I hope these people are really who they are, because you don't know. So
we have to remember, these facilities are not designed for security, and maybe in the future all will be.
Yeah.
But, most of our, buildings are designed for ingress and egress. We want people to get in there, quickly. We want them to have visitors. I just recently gave a seminar on mass casualty crisis management. And, my audience was mostly, emergency room personnel, doctors and nurses and other, medical providers, first responders. And, we talked about, the problem is after a mass casualty event, could be terrorism, could be shooting, what is the security of the hospital at that point? Because no one really thinks about that. And there's continuing threats after the event that might occur at the hospital. Again, they're not tuned in for that. The job right there is to start saving lives. But in this day and age, they have to now consider what is their security response, and maybe even locking down a hospital, based on what the event was.
I agree. That's what gets me scared. I mean, you don't know. And I'm looking into the operating room and going like, wait a minute. And I did. I said to them, who are you? What's your job? How do I know you for real? Do you have an ID? And they all did. They identified themselves. And the guy that was taking the picture of what they were taking out of me, I said, if you put it on Facebook, I'm going to have your head. But I wanted to make
right.
Yeah, seriously. I said, do
yeah,
I get
but, you know, I'm sure they didn't mind showing it. I mean, no one likes to be questioned, but I'm sure they understood. We live in that kind of world. And look, we've had phony doctors, show up at these hospitals.
Yeah,
I've seen a couple of cases of those I can think off the top of my head. So there's nothing wrong with asking that, nothing wrong with checking. If I was in that situation, I'd watch everything they're doing. I know when you want to get my physical, I watch what needle they take out, make sure they're taking it out of a fresh box. And one time someone started, I didn't see them take it out, and they asked me to do it over again just to make sure we're safe. Nothing wrong with that. It's our own safety.
I would
responsibility for it.
I seriously did. I mean, I seriously do, because I said to the anesthesiologist, okay, explain your procedure, explain what you're going to give me, and I want to see it in writing, and I want to understand what you're doing. They looked at me like nobody ever asked that before. And the guy that was taking the pictures, I said, how do I know you belong here? And then I said, you're not putting me out until the doctor walks in, because I want to make sure it's the right person that's going to cut me open. And,
right, exactly.
it was probably the shortest surgery in the history of America, but whatever. When everyone was evacuated and taken to the hospital, did they find everybody that was missing, or there's still people that are missing?
The last I heard is everybody's been accounted for. I remember there was one family waiting to hear from the young girl. She hadn't responded, and I believe she was identified. So, yes, everyone has been recovered.
That is
at least
so
that's
sad.
The news I heard.
Well, Theresa May, I don't know how people feel about her. I've listened to her on the news. She's so upset and so aggravated, What did the Prime Minister say to the citizens of Manchester, and they didn't have the high-level security at the concert? What is she doing now to prevent that from happening, since Ariana Grande said that she's going to pay for the funerals of all those people that died, you know, the families, to pay for the funerals of the people that died, and she's coming back to do a One Love concert in Manchester. So what is she going to do that's different this time?
Well, you know, I think there will be heightened security just because. Now, let me first say, I think what Ariana Grande is doing is fantastic.
Yeah, I think so, too.
We need to spit in the face of ISIS, and that's what she's doing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're sending that message that we will not be intimidated. And what's interesting, and I'm going to get off the subject here for a second, I'll come back, but when you think about terrorism, it's always been political. You know, the terrorist groups have a political agenda. That's what makes it terrorism. You know, if you go with the, you know, the statutes, the definition of terrorism, it has to do with those who have a political agenda. They're trying to change something in the country or the government. They're trying to intimidate a government into doing something different in terms of policy. If I ask the general person, which I do now and then, I say, what is ISIS's agenda? Very few people know what it is. Now, you know, if you follow them, you look it up, it'll obviously be the establishment of a global caliphate. But very few people know. So when ISIS or anyone who's ISIS aspired commits these attacks, you never hear the discussion, oh, what is ISIS trying to accomplish? Or, oh, should we consider their point of view? Or oh, do we need to negotiate with them? No, it only hardens the world's resolve to destroy them, you know, primarily on the battlefield. So they don't really accomplish any political gain when they commit these acts. So if you ask people, what does ISIS do? They'll say, oh, they commit terror to terrorize, which is true. So when we show that we're going to go back and have a concert and not be intimidated, we're in a sense almost minimizing their ability to terrorize us. We're showing that, you know, the world won't be terrorized. So we're diminishing them as a terrorist organization just in ourselves of doing that. So I think it's terrific they're doing that. So to go back to your question, what security? There will be heightened security. Again, worry about someone trying to prove a point, whether it's ISIS or someone, you know, deranged individual thinks he's acting in behalf of ISIS. There'll be a hardened security. They'll probably be checking more bags, probably more uniform security, uniform police at the event as a visual deterrent and also just to feel good. And I don't mean that sarcastically, but, you know, sometimes you just have to make people feel secure because they will be worried. But we have to remember, though, this did not occur in the venue, so I don't think we can show fault with venue security. It happened on the way out, and as you and I just discussed at the, you know, beginning of the show, there's always going to be a soft target. So the question is, you know, how far do we extend it? Of course, this time they will extend it. They will have more security, probably at all the throughways, you know, leading to the areas of transportation. They'll probably have a large contingent of uniformed police and security at the areas of transportation, the transportation hubs, and probably extend that perimeter out significantly what we would see otherwise. So I believe there'll be a very, very high-profile uniform presence. I believe they'll engage more bomb-sniffing dogs. I believe they'll engage more cameras and surveillance. I believe they'll engage more plainclothes personnel on the outskirts to look for suspicious behavior.
Do these people ever try to infiltrate these security areas? Do they ever try to work?
You know, I've only heard that in theory. It would make sense that they did. You want to get in a trusted area. They do try to compromise people in these areas, get the cooperation. Mm-hmm. I know it's always something we'd be concerned about. I am not familiar, with any story yet. I know, we had, I can't remember which shooting it was. The person himself was a security guard. But I don't think that was related to infiltration. I think that was just the nature of their work. That's a very good question. I think it's something I was aware of, which is why in the security industries and the police departments, there's, you know, very, very stringent background screening, you know, before someone's admitted in there. And we need to keep that up. And in all facilities where, you know, they work in something that's, you know, in the power grid or anything, private industry, we're involved with the infrastructure, government contracts, or anything that might be, something politically sensitive, you need to be screening those people. That's a little self-serving since my company does background screening for firms. But it's true. You need to really screen because the chance of infiltration, the chance of people trying to get in there and do damage is real. And I know one of my clients, you know, I'm not going to mention who they are or their industry, but they have an ultra concern because of what they do with people deliberately trying to get employment there to sabotage them from the inside. So we, you know, we're very cautious about their background screenings, and we check a lot of different information. So it's a very good point. I don't know if it's been done successfully, at least here, and if it has, you know, maybe I just can't think of one, but it's certainly a threat everyone needs to be aware of. And all the industries who feel they have any exposure to that, you know, someone being politically motivated to get in there, needs to be doing their due diligence. And everybody that works in there, vendors who walk in there, visitors who walk in there, they need to be protecting themselves for their sake and for the sake of our society.
I agree. I just finished a book by Gary Grossman, which brought this to mind because it was called Executive Actions. And it's a group of people, a guy that wanted to become a president of the United States and his chief of staff. And basically, they took over the identity of the real person. And they actually, the guy actually won the Democratic nomination until somebody realized that he was Americanized and that he was part of this situation called the Red Banner, which I think it does exist. And they put them through this thing so that they would become Americanized and that you wouldn't know that where they came from before. And that's what's even more frightening, because that could actually happen. And, you know, you walk in the street and go like, who are you? Who do you, you know, who do you think you are? And so this 23-year-old guy, the bomb attached to his chest, thought that he was going to wind up and nobody saw him. So what would have happened? I mean, the fact that he's dead is no is good or bad. I mean, because they can't question him, which makes it even worse.
They can't. But, you know, one thing I say, and I don't mean this in a flippant way, but dead men do tell tales. Once you've identified that person, there's a lot of information and intelligence that will unravel from that. So the fact that he's dead, yes, we can't question him, but look what they were able to do afterwards. They still rounded up a lot of people. They were able to identify this network. Everybody today is leaving a digital footprint out there, a big one. So even if you're, you die in a bomb and your body blows up, you still have left a lot of information behind that law enforcement is going to unravel and uncover. So, yes, he's committed a suicide bomb for whatever reason he sees, but no, that did not stop the investigation from moving forward, and nor will it in the future.
That's good. So when they realized the magnitude of what happened and ISIS claimed responsibility and she raised the level of security, is she worried that this is going to happen again, the Prime Minister of Britain?
Absolutely. I always hope that we never start raising security unnecessarily, because we don't want people to become sort of, immune to it and, not take it seriously when it does happen, which I think did happen earlier years in the United States. They did away with the color code. It just seemed we're always in a constant state. So we want people to take it seriously, to be extra alert, though. I always feel we should be doing that anyway, irrespective of the, level of threat. But, yes, once you see there's more people there involved in this bombing or any terrorist event, you're always worried about the next shoe that's going to drop. So other than the fact we have to hold them accountable, this terror activity question, this wasn't the only thing they're going to do. That's not how, terrorist groups operate. Just like any criminal enterprise, they're going to do more for whatever reason that motivates them. So they have to dismantle that. And the fear is if we don't dismantle this group quickly, they may pull off another bombing, or there's, one lone person out there who's got, his finger on the trigger or something, and he's going to do that before we take everybody down. So, the threat level is there because there's more people there engaged in the conspiracy. We need to stop whatever it is they're planning to do next.
What do we know about this guy, where he came from? And was this the work of some of the articles I read said that was a sleeper cell or a huge network, but it's hard to tell. So what do we know about him and where he came from? And they said was he a British citizen? He grew up there? He grew up in Britain anyway?
I think that was true. But I think his family, were immigrants there. But, this is the typical, I don't want to say profile, the kind of bomber that we see, young men. All right, in my opinion, I don't know enough of his profile, his personality, but somehow they're disaffected, they're in a state of ennui. And, they're just looking for something for this fulfillment and thinking they're going to find something, by being a suicide bomber. Whatever it is in their personality, their existence, that they get radicalized, whether, it's from people who really have some connection with them, whether it's the heritage, religion, or something else, and they're able to, use that affinity. It's like an affinity, a type of crime where you bring someone in based on something you have in common and, get them to see things the way you want them to see it, and they're open to this manipulation. How could someone be, talked into believing that blowing yourself up and killing a bunch of innocent people is somehow good. And no rational individual could believe that. And so you have to have sort of this short circuit in this person, this personality flaw, whether it's inborn or just something that's happened during the course of his lifetime, that makes him vulnerable to this. And that's what happens. They get influenced by people that they share something in common with, or, you know, for some reason they trust, and we wind up where we are.
So why did his father, they interviewed his father. I have the article in front of me.
Right.
From the Telegraph. I was so, like, taken with this whole thing, and I'm saying, like, he said, the Eldad didn't deny that he was part of a militant group and told the Associated Press that his son was not involved in the concert bombing and had no connection to militants. That's impossible. And then he said he spoke to his son 5 days before, and he was getting ready for a religious pilgrimage to Saudi Arabia, and then his son visited Libya, and he said he sounded normal. He didn't see any signs or anything that his son was going to do something like this?
Well,
and then
they
arrested the other one.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, that's okay. Then they arrested the two others, the 18-year-old son, and they arrested, then they detained the father. So nobody realized anything? Nobody in the family?
Well, maybe they did realize it, and maybe, this is all part of a bigger plan. When we get these interviews of, let's just look here, get a mass shooter here in the United States. Mm-hmm. And you interview people, and it couldn't have been him. It's not that person. He's not the person I know. I don't believe it. What they're saying is true. They don't believe it. They didn't see it. But we can never take those interviews as, the truth of what was going on in that person's mm-hmm. mind. People don't see it. I know a couple of cases I've asked them to consult on here were suicides, where the police called it suicide, family saying not possible. But I know they mean well, and in their hearts they didn't see it, but families and people who are close to the individual are not the best judges of what's going on, because when we love someone, we care for someone, we tend to see the best in them. We mm-hmm. don't see it. So especially parents. I mean, how many of us as parents can really see a dark side to our own children? And we'll be able to, willing even to admit to ourselves as that child. So when we get these interviews, it's not always necessarily that someone's lying or, someone's trying to twist the facts. It's they're telling you what they believe, but we can't really accept that as the truth because they're not in the best position to judge. So whenever I hear these statements, but this person said that, I'll be honest with you, I dismiss them because, people don't know the truth. People can be lying intentionally or unintentionally or just responding from emotion. I always say, let's go with the facts, go with the evidence, look at any bias that might exist in someone's statement. Of course, when you judge what they say, but just let the evidence decide, and run the case. Statements from people, they really don't have much credibility, either intentionally or unintentionally. So when I hear that, I'm like, I don't really care what they're saying. That doesn't affect what we know and what the evidence tells us.
I agree. Also, there's another point. By not calling them names and not identifying them and just sticking to the fact that this happened, the Manchester attack and how many people, without literally calling the people that did this evil or horrible or whatever, I think makes more sense than saying, recognizing that they're even there. Just discounting the fact that they even exist, because calling them evil or monsters, that's what they want. That's what they like. It's like a kid that does something wrong and say, you're horrible, you did that wrong. That's what they want. I mean, how do you deal with that? I mean, I haven't heard the Prime Minister of England call them names. She's just dealing with the facts and what's happened. And yet some people here have called them evil and horrible. How do you deal with that without, giving them, the courtesy that they don't deserve?
That's a really interesting question that you posed there. Several years ago, I wrote a blog about the mass shooter. And, I forgot what I call it. I'm a shooter, you will know my name. Because when they commit those acts, they have a story that they want told. And when they commit that, what winds up happening? We tell their story. You know, we give out the name, we talk about his motivation, we start interviewing people, talk about his life and what happened, how this all led, because we do have a curiosity. You know, some of it's an unhealthy curiosity, but some of it's a healthy curiosity to try to understand the criminal mind, because how could someone commit, you know, these kind of mass murders just with innocent people? But in that blog, I talk about the fact that I felt we should never talk about the person and what their message is in the life. Again, because that's just what they want. We should talk about the event, just as you're saying now. Talk about the event. We have, you know, it's important news. We should report it. We should pay respect to the victims and their families, you know, and let them know they have our support and our prayers. Of course, that's important. But telling the story of the killer is not important. And I don't. It's not realistic. I don't think it's going to happen. We have a free press. We do have this curiosity that people are going to demand from the media, so I don't see it happening. But in terms of principle, I think it's the right idea. So I think calling people names and saying whether you call it this type of terrorism, I don't think that's going to affect anything. I don't think they're worried about what the press or, you know, a prime minister or president calls them, names them, you know, whatever rubric they want to put it under, has any effect on what they're doing. I just can't see them feeling, oh, they called me this instead of this, and now I'm going to reconsider my views, where they made me feel bad. I just don't see that it has any effect. I agree with you. I like to see us report the event, you know, report that arrests were made, you know, and talk about any threats we see. Obviously, not withhold important security information from the public, but to tell their story. But then again, there is another point. Now let me get the other point. You know, we put out the picture, we put out the name. There's a law enforcement intelligence purpose for doing that. Of course, then you know, we show these pictures of the person. People say, "Oh, wait a second, I saw him. I saw him, like, you know, in a car." Or I think they uncovered a picture of him, I think, with some sort of luggage or something that's not been recovered. That's potentially dangerous. So the other part is, by putting out the name, we may have people come up and say, "Well, I knew this guy, and I met him at a bar 3 weeks ago, and he was with so-and-so." So there is certainly a law enforcement purpose for putting that information. So I think we're not going to hide their identity, but maybe we should just leave it at that and, you know, not talk about what their motivation is, not, you know, sort of lionize them by talking about the life story and all that. But that's just not realistic. That's not going to happen. We have a curiosity. And, again, there is some, again, intellectual curiosity and some academic reasons for wanting to study them and understanding what got them to where they are.
Well, before I forget, this should be very interesting tomorrow. First of all, let me say hi to Cheryl from Partners in Crime, the best people in the world to do blog tours for mystery writers. And they're fantastic. She's listening to the show. She's on. She called in. Tomorrow I'm going to be talking about the novel by Pat Graff, Genocide. And if you read the novel, you'll learn exactly the definition of what happened in Manchester. And even worse, when you read this book, it's frightening. The book is fantastic, and the concept is really scary. There's a group of people called the Capital Sinners, and they've decided who should live and who should die, and that's all I'm going to say about it. On Monday, I'm going to interview the author of A Stranger Inside, Jennifer Janes. And on the 12th, I am so excited, Shifting Sands, all the way from Japan, Michael Shisko. And the show is at, I'm going to be, I hope I'm awake at 8 o'clock in the morning, which will be 9 o'clock his time. And the final show for June will be Find Imitation. And I'm going to be taking the month of July off from my radio shows. But those book reviews will keep them coming. I'm sure they will be. So before we close, what can the nations of the world learn about fighting terrorism together? How can you bring them down? And what can we do to make even kids in school realize that hate and racism and prejudice is wrong? How do we teach them in school, you know, that not to be like that? And how do we teach people that when they walk down the street and see somebody of another nationality, they shouldn't prejudge them as to, "Oh, you're horrible, I'm not going to go near you"? How can we change that, or can we?
Well, you know, and that's a big, broad question there, you know, and people like yourself, the professional educators, probably better equipped to, you know, how to decide how to teach our kids better than I. But again, we do have to teach tolerance. We do have to teach differences. We have to, as a world and as a nation, but as a world, take away the environments, destroy the environments that breed hatred and breed terrorism. And there are socio-cultural and economic atmospheres and environments that do breed it, and we need to attack those together. because the world is flat, as a famous author said, you know, and, you know, what's happening in some foreign country, you know, halfway across the world can and does affect us. We know that. So it's in all our best interest to work together, you know, to, you know, eradicate that environment. And then we have to work together, sharing intelligence, right, protecting intelligence, working cooperatively. You know, again, we have different laws in different countries. We have to respect that. It's going to be an imperfect collaboration between the governments, the intelligence communities, the law enforcement communities. But again, I've been out of the business for 10 years now, but going back to when I was there and the year before that, we worked well with foreign countries, the FBI and the CIA. We have stations all over the world. We work with everybody cooperatively. It can be done. Again, we have to respect each other's proprietary information. We have to work in the confines of everybody's laws. But it's working together. It's recognizing a common goal. And it's attacking prejudice and hatred wherever we can through education. And we have to attack the terrorisms, the terrorist cells, as we discussed earlier, from very, very many, several different ways: intelligence, surveillance, law enforcement action, and military. The military is part of it. It's cold, it's bloody, it's people are going to get killed. Young men and women of ours will be lost in a fight. But unfortunately, that is just one of the ways we have to attack them, as we're attacking ISIS now in a cooperative manner.
Well, hopefully someday there won't be ISIS and there won't be any terrorism in the world. So when somebody gets trained to the FBI or the police department or the CIA or anything, they're actually trained in terrorism and counterterrorism, and they actually should know what to do, I would hope.
Well, we know. I mean, in the FBI, during your course of your career, I know – you know, since I've left, they talked about career paths for agents and different things, and then we always talk about the fact that we need to have a broad, you know, experience. You know, my FBI career was mostly criminal as an agent, but then when you get into management, you have to manage BI. So I'm managing terrorism cases, foreign counterintelligence cases. So you really have to have a broad base of knowledge in the FBI and the CIA, too. Intelligence is not just terrorism. We, you know, we look at countries spying on us for economic reasons, you know, economic espionage. And espionage just from trade secrets, not necessarily, you know, having anything to do with terrorism per se. So law enforcement tells you there's a broad base of knowledge you have to have. But, yes, to answer your question, we are trained in those. You learn it in the academies. You know, CIA has theirs. We have ours. All the law enforcement intelligence communities have the basic training. And then you learn as you go, and we adapt. You know, we made massive changes after 9/11. And with every new threat, we'll adapt to the new threat. But, of course, you know, we'll always be a step behind because you just don't know what the next trend is going to be, what the next crime wave is going to be, what the next terrorism wave is going to be. We don't know what socioeconomic, political factors are going to weigh into the next wave of terrorism. So we just adapt, and we adapt quickly.
That's what's scary. You know, after reading the, I don't know how many thousands of books on this, that you often wonder also in these in the stock market or in any agency or any organization or any corporation or any even security or any law enforcement, if there are people that are giving secrets to foreign countries. You often wonder if there are any moles there. I just finished a book like that. That's why, I mean, I'm like, oh, my God, you know, could this really happen? And I guess it might be it could. So how could they stop that?
Oh, it has. I mean, we've had it in the FBI, Fran. We've had agents gone bad and sold secrets just during the course of my career. I can think of a couple off the top of my head. So, yeah, it does happen.
Wow. Do we have a new director yet, or is he still the acting one? This one.
Still the acting one. And I wouldn't be too worried about that in terms of security and safety and the efficacy of the FBI. Someone's there at the helm. I just wouldn't worry about that. He will appoint someone when he gets to it. But honestly, the choice of director, I don't think will significantly change the path of the FBI. Hopefully, certainly nothing to do with the Russian investigation. We'll get deterred by that. But just in terms of generally speaking, in general terms of the FBI, who the director is hasn't really, of course, in my career, had a major impact on our operations, you know, and I'm sure they're just fine now. They'll continue on. You know, they're sort of a self-generating machine, so I wouldn't worry about the fact that no one's been appointed yet. The FBI will continue to do what it does.
So before we end, tell everybody about your work and your books, and when are you writing the next Mark Zuccarelli? I'm ready for him. I'm ready to interview him.
Well, actually, I've been working on it for a long time. I know,
yeah,
and
forgotten.
I did tell the real detective that you're going to have him on one time. He's very excited by it. He and I have been, you know, just good friends since we worked together more than 30 years ago on organized crime back in New York. He's a great guy. So he's excited by that. He was just, after my book came out, he was like, yeah, maybe I don't want too many books written about me. I said, you know, be careful what you ask for in life. But I am working on, but as you know, I have writing, author is not my full-time job. I have two businesses I run. One's a security company. I do background screening for big employers, and I do security consulting with them on internal matters. I have another business I run. So writing, unfortunately, I don't have much time for, but I am working on a book, and I really need to get back at it. Keep getting distracted, but I would like to get it out there, and it's going to go to you first for review. No question about that.
Oh, thank you, because I sent you mine first, the one
I'm doing. I owe you. I owe you to look at
the
that
blurb.
Book.
Yes, I'm so excited about that one. So everybody, I am really, really. This is great, Mike. Thank you so very, very much. I want everybody to have a safe day. And like we said, if you see something you're not sure, say something. It's better if you're wrong. I know from being an educator, when there were parents, kids that came in, and I wasn't sure if somebody abused them or somebody hurt them, I reported it. And unfortunately, I was never wrong. And I did save some lives along the way of parents that had to learn that you're not going to do it on my watch, not ever. So on that note, I will be back tomorrow with the author of Genocide. You got to listen to it because, believe me, everything that we talked about today is in that book, and it's a really good book. But what can I say? I often wonder sometimes, you know, if people get an idea from what people write to do something that's wrong. I don't know. So, Mike, thank you so very much. And,
it's always good to be with you, friend. Thank you.
The next time you want to do another one, let me just email me and let me know. There's a lot of people listening. Author Christina Hoag is out there, and Joseph Ruin, and Cheryl from Partners in Crime. There's a whole bunch of people that are listening and telling me that this is great, and I'm sure they're going to listen in about 5 minutes when I make the show go public. I've decided to make the show private so that I get only the people that I want to listen. And I don't give out the phone number too often because there are people out there that don't appreciate the fact that I'm spotlighting the work or the thoughts of other people. And that's going to just stay the way it is. So thank you so much, Mike. Everybody, have a great day. And I will talk to you soon. And bye.
Bye-bye.